Have you ever felt like you had a task before you that was too big for you to handle? Or you looked at it and you thought, this is going to be impossible. I don't have it in me. I don't have the capability. I'm not able to do this. There are a lot of times people feel that way. They feel overwhelmed. They feel as though no matter how hard they try, they might not be good enough. I'm a Texas Longhorns fan, and if you follow college football at all, you might know that they're actually doing quite poorly. They're on a 6-game losing streak. It's the worst. After 5 games, I think it was the worst since like 1956, and I don't know now. Maybe it's still that same year. But either way, it's not been a fun season. It's also the first season of our new head coach. And so I wonder what goes through his mind. Like, late at night when he's leaving the office, is he thinking, am I going to have a future here? Am I going to be able to turn this thing around? It's a pretty big task. If you watch the games, they're bad at virtually everything, so there's a lot to fix. And so the question is, like, are you able to do this? And I can't help but wonder if he asks himself that question. There are times where I've seen people given huge responsibilities, and the question is, are you up to this? When I think about our lives as Christians, I like the passage where Jesus says in John chapter 9, I am the light of the world. It makes me a little less comfortable in Matthew chapter 5 when Jesus says, you are the light of the world. And I think, well, I think you're better at that than me. You do that, Jesus. I like the idea of you saying we're the light of the world, but I know me. And if the world is looking for light, you're going to be much better at that than me. But Jesus doesn't only say that he is the light of the world. He also tells us to be the light of the world. Like, we are the people through whom people can see God's goodness. That's quite a challenge. That's quite a responsibility that he places on us. And are we up to it? Can you live in that way? Can we live like the salt of the earth? Be the light of the world? Be the city that's set on a hill? That's a huge task and a huge responsibility. When I talk to people who are in church leadership, elders, or people who are taking on ministry, or people who are teaching classes and working with the church, and people who have these responsibilities, I think it's important to ask ourselves these types of questions. Is this something that we're able to accomplish? And a lot of times, I would say, no. That's actually what our lesson's going to be on. This morning, we were talking about how human beings oftentimes aren't very good at overcoming those temptations and those lusts and those things that ensnare us and that trap us. Human beings on our own actually aren't great at accomplishing a tremendous amount. When we have community, we can do a whole lot better. But more than anything else, when we have God and what God has done for us. What I want to do tonight is talk briefly about two different leaders in Israel who had a monumental task before them. And they were both thinking, I don't think we can do this. This isn't something we're capable of. This is something that's bigger than us. And God encourages them, yes, you can. And it's not because of how great you are. It's because the Lord works through you. You know, there's a really important passage that I keep in my mind from 1 Corinthians chapter 3 that says, I planted and Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. When it comes to church work, I'm convinced, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so, I'm convinced that you can't make a church grow. I don't think I can make a church grow. A lot of times people will look at the elders, or they'll look at the ministers, or they'll look at the different ministries of the church, and they'll think, these should be making the church grow. And I don't know that that's the right way to think about things. When it comes to your responsibility before God, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, like, God didn't send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. Here's the idea. He has a mission, and he has a job, and he's working for that job, and he's preaching the gospel. And baptism is either going to happen or it's not going to happen. But he can't make people be baptized. He can't force people to be baptized. He can preach the gospel. That's what he can do. When it comes to how people respond to that, that's not really up to him. When it comes to church growth, you can preach, you can work, you can have ministries, you can plant, and you can water. That's the stuff you can do, and you should do. That's important stuff. But as for whether or not it leads to more people coming, that's ultimately God. Like, that's in his court. And so a passage that I like to remember is Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10. we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which he prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. That passage is saying you are created to do the works of God. You were created to work. You were created with a mission. You were created with a task. Like, God has a job for you, and you can do that job. Whether that leads to a church becoming 10,000 people, I don't know what's going to happen. But you can do your job. You can do what you're tasked to do, and you can do it the very best that you can. Are you good enough to make a church grow? No, no one is. But God can make a church grow. Are you good enough to make the greatest, most successful ministry of all time? Probably not. But you'd be amazed at what God can do. Jesus says, with man, it is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. When he's asked the question, then who then can be saved after his encounter with the rich young ruler? I would suggest that there are probably a lot of things that that's true with. It's impossible with men, but with God, you'd be amazed at what is possible. So this lesson's going to be about the fact that we have a job before us as Christians. And it's a job that it's going to be difficult. We are, you know, tasked with being the light of the world. We're tasked with being the salt of the earth, with being the city that's set on a hill. And doing it on our own, by our own merit and by our own goodness, we'll probably struggle and fail. But you'd be amazed at what God could accomplish through people who are willing to work. And so I want to look at these two leaders of Israel. One of them's name is Joshua, and he's not the one that you're thinking of. He's not the famous Joshua. He's the way less famous Joshua. And another one whose name is Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was like the governor of Israel after they returned home from Babylonian captivity. And Joshua was the high priest of Israel at that same time. So one of them was kind of like the political leader, and the other one was kind of like the religious leader, the high priest and the governor. And they have this huge task. This task is to take a bunch of people who have lived for the last 70 years as exiles. Most of them have never even been to Israel in their whole lives. Like, this is a brand new thing. They're returning home to Jerusalem, and when they get there, the city is in ruins. Their houses have been destroyed. Their farms have been plundered and are left with nothing. The structures of the city lie in ruins. The temple itself has been desolated. Like, they look at the city. The walls around the city are down and crumpled. Even if they build, they don't really have any protection if anyone wants to go to destroy them. It's a very difficult thing to return home and see, especially if you've been growing up hearing stories about the grandeur of Israel. If you grew up hearing stories about King David and King Solomon. I remember several years ago taking a trip to California with my parents and Lauren, and we saw some family there. I was raised in California when I was a kid. And the house that we lived in, it was on Via del Sol. You know, I remember the road, and I remember playing baseball there at the house, and I remember, like, I have a lot of memories of growing up there. I was about 11 when we moved from that house. Then I went back and I saw it as an adult. And I was kind of amazed at several things. One, the baseball field was not as big as I remembered. I thought it was really, really impressive to be able to hit a home run out of that thing. But that baseball field was virtually nothing when I went back and looked at it. Also, a lot of the work that we had done on the house, the people who bought the house, the guy was a truck driver. And he parked like 18-wheelers there in the yard of the house, like they were just, you know, there. And so you go through, and the yard didn't look quite as good as it once did. And then there was this big, like, 30-foot antenna just kind of like sitting on top of the house. And then we went to the back of the house and kind of looked around back there, just kind of driving around. And you could see that, like, it had just grown up, and there were weeds and all sorts of things. And there used to be like a little, basically it was like a shack that we would play in back there. And it was like in ruins. And basically kind of looked at the house and realized, this isn't quite what I remember. It looks a little bit worse than the memories I have of growing up in this house. It was kind of depressing, actually, to go back and see it. I can't help but wonder what the children of Israel felt like when they returned to Israel and they saw the dump that they had left behind. They saw that Babylon had destroyed it and it was left in ruins. What are you going to do now? Well, there are a couple things they were supposed to do, and the task is monumental. We got to rebuild a city. We got to get home, and we have to get our lives back in order. We have to get our houses. We have to get our farms. We have to get life back in Israel. But not only that, most importantly, we have to get the temple restored. We have to get the temple built back up. We have to get worship in Israel taking place again. And so this huge task was given to a guy named Joshua and a guy named Zerubbabel to lead the people in this mission. And yet Joshua and Zerubbabel, it's not like they've had the most impressive track records either. They were also in Babylon. Like, think of the name Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel. Babylon is actually in his name. His name means seed of Babylon. Basically, he's someone who was born in Babylon. You know who his grandfather was? A king of Israel, and not a very good one. His grandfather was this king of Israel who God eventually rejected, and then Israel went into Babylonian captivity. You can read about his grandfather in Jeremiah chapter 24. Look with me at Jeremiah chapter 24. Sorry, Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 24, sorry. Jeremiah 22 and verse 24 says, "As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, or Jeconiah sometimes he's called, son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off. And I will give you over into the hand of those who are seeking your life. Yes, into the hand of those whom you dread, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans." That's not a very encouraging verse to hear about your grandfather. You have the famous prophet Jeremiah, who's not saying good things about your family. What he's saying about your grandfather is, if he were a signet ring on my finger, that's like the ring a king would wear. It would have his mark on it. And when there was an official document from the king, he could put his stamp on that with his ring. You put it in oil and wax, and it makes a mark there. And people know this is official from the king. The signet ring carried the authority of the king. And God said, "Coniah, you were like a signet ring on my finger. And you know what I'm doing? I'm taking you off. You don't have my authority anymore. As a matter of fact, I'm giving you up. I'm giving you over to those whom you fear and those whom you dread, the Babylonians." And guess what? The Babylonians took advantage. They destroyed the city. They put an end to the monarchy. There was no king in Israel anymore. They brought them to live as captives and exiles in Babylon. Now they've returned back home, and Zerubbabel, the guy who was born in Babylon, has to pick up where his family left off, kind of like leading the people. Although he's not even leading as a king anymore. His family used to be kings, but now they're not allowed to have kings. And so he's kind of like the governor, and he's trying to do this, but everything is way worse and less impressive now. And yet he's being told, it's up to you to lead these people, to accomplish this great task. I think that he was pretty discouraged. There's a couple of reasons why I think that. But I think that he's someone who did not have confidence in what he was able to accomplish. There are two minor prophets that are written, Haggai and Zechariah. And they are written largely to encourage the children of Israel to get back to work and to rebuild the temple. And you know what both of them do? They both spend some time trying to encourage Zerubbabel and trying to encourage Joshua the high priest, trying to show them that God is actually with you and you're going to be able to do this. Like, you might not be able to do it because of your own strength. You might not be able to do it because of your own might. You might not be able to do it because of your great family history or how intelligent you are, but you do have a pretty powerful God on your side. You will be able to accomplish this. And so you can see some really encouraging texts. There's also some words of condemnation in those in those two books, because, you know, there's necessary words of judgment. But you'll see quite a bit that is encouraging those two leaders. Look with me at the book of Haggai. Speaking of the book of Haggai, this is nothing to do with the lesson. It's just kind of a funny story, I think. But so when I first started preaching, I was preaching in Denison, Texas, and I had never really studied Haggai all that much, and I thought, I want to learn more about Haggai. So I spent some time studying it. I liked it. Haggai is basically four different proclamations about rebuilding the temple, and two of them are pretty positive, and two of them aren't so positive, and it's there's a lot of encouragement in there. There's a lot of challenging stuff in there, and I thought, I'm going to turn this into a series. At that time, I didn't really plan out my sermons like I do now. I usually have my sermons planned out pretty well in advance. I try to look up when holidays are and try to look up when things are going on at church and all that stuff, and try to, you know, strategize. Back then, I would come up with an idea, and I'd say, all right, I'm going to preach on this. And so I still got four sermons to preach on the book of Haggai. I also wasn't very clever with names of sermons. I'm still not clever with names. And so the sermon titles were Haggai Part 1, Haggai Part 2, Haggai Part 3, and Haggai Part 4. And you want to know what my very first Easter sermon I ever preached was? Haggai Part 3. This is a pretty solid name for an Easter sermon, I think. That was when I first started. I thought it was an okay sermon. People didn't go. There was like the big crowd, and they're all going to hear Haggai Part 3. I'm like, okay, wonderful. Anyway, all of that is to say, I like Haggai. And actually, Haggai Part 3 can make a decent Easter sermon if you work at it. Look with me at Haggai Chapter 1 and Verse 1. It says, in the second year of Darius the king, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, high priest. So these messages are for these two men. And the first one is basically telling them, hey, you need to start working on the temple again. Apparently what had happened was the children of Israel had gotten back home and they said, we're going to rebuild the temple. And so they laid the foundation of the temple. They were going to start building it. But you know what you also kind of have to do? You have to have a place to live, right? So then they started working on their own homes. And you have to have a source of income, right? So they started working on their own fields. And you have to be able to take care of your family. And all of a sudden, they started working on all of their own little projects. And once you put something off and you kind of put it on the back burner or you put it on the back shelf, you don't think about it so much anymore. And year after year passed, and they never did anything else with the temple. Like, they laid the foundation, and then they forgot about it. And it seems like about 16 years passed, and they hadn't done anything else with the temple. And so the first prophecy in Haggai is saying, hey, don't forget about the temple. Get your priorities in order here. Yes, you're working on your own houses, you're working on your own, but where's the Lord's house? Work on his house. You have work to do here. And so there was this admonition to start working on the house of the Lord. Then the second prophecy, it's in chapter 2 and verse 1. You can see they're all dated. It says, on the 21st of the seventh month, the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet saying. And in this one, it's a word of encouragement because imagine you're rebuilding the temple. The previous one was built by Solomon in all of his wisdom and glory and all of like the greatest, basically the greatest wood and the greatest gold from like all over the ancient world was being brought into Israel. And he had all these contacts. He had all these alliances. He had married all these women, like all this stuff. He was able to build a tremendous, beautiful, monumental temple. And then they come back and they've been exiled in Babylon for 40 years and they don't have any gold and they don't have any silver. They don't have this great, they don't even have a king anymore. And now they have to build this temple. They don't have contacts around the ancient world who are going to help get them the best cedar and the best. And so like they're building this temple and apparently it's not looking quite like they hoped that it would. They're putting work into it, but it's not a beautiful temple. And so this message comes from the Lord saying basically, don't worry about that. The latter glory of this temple will be greater even than the former. And by the way, all the gold and all the silver in the world, that belongs to me anyway. It's like God's like, I don't need it in a temple to have a special temple. I own all the gold and I own all the silver. You just build, you work, you do what's right and see what happens. Kind of like we started off this lesson saying, you know, sometimes you might have this monumental task and you think, I don't think I can do it. I can't build a rich, fabulous temple. Well, maybe not, but God can give glory to even the temple that you are building. God can do pretty incredible things even when you have failures or weaknesses or you're not quite as capable as you'd like to be. The third prophecy is in verse 10 of chapter 2. It says, on the 24th of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet saying, and then it starts off with a series of questions to these priests. And this is actually a word of judgment here. The question is asked something like this. All right, let's say you have something that's unclean, and you touch that unclean thing, and then you go and you touch a bunch of other stuff. What happens to that uncleanness? Well, it spreads to everything that you touched, right? Okay, well, what happens if you have something that's clean, like something that's sacred, and you go and you start touching unclean things? What is that going to do? Well, it's not going to cleanse them. You're just going to defile it, basically. If you're unclean by a dead body, you're supposed to avoid going in and offering, you know, sacrifice for a while. What if you go in and you start touching everything? Well, then you defile it. Here's the point. Uncleanness spreads, but cleanness doesn't. I mean, we understand this. If you take a person who's healthy, doesn't have any sickness, and you take a person who has COVID, right, and they start breathing on each other, what's going to spread, the health or the COVID? Probably COVID. I mean, that probably, I mean, definitely, I'm not saying definitely will spread, but there's no way someone's going to get healthy from having a clean breath put on them. Imagine you have this nice, clean glass of water, and you have like old, gross, uncooked, raw, slimy chicken. And you take that chicken and you pick it up and you drop it in the water. That chicken's good to eat now, right? Because it touched good, pure, clean water. Or that water has been contaminated and you don't want to drink it. Well, the uncleanness spreads. We don't want to drink that water now. That'd be gross. That's kind of the point. Uncleanness spreads. And so the question is, if you're building the temple and you're living unclean, impure, and unholy lives, what's going to happen? Is God going to say, oh, it's fine if you're living that way because my temple's pretty clean. My temple's sanctified, so if you're working on the temple, you can do whatever you want. Or is your unclean, impure, and unholy life going to defile the work that you're doing on the temple? The point is, if you're living an impure life, it doesn't matter if you're building a temple or not. You're defiling the temple. I mean, I would say in the same way, if we are, you know, greedy and violent and lustful and we're committing adultery and like all this stuff, and then we come and we sing to God on Sunday, is God going to say, wow, your voice is so beautiful, I'll just ignore all that other stuff? Or is God going to say, don't sing a song to me while you're living that kind of life. Don't act like you love me when you clearly don't love me. The way scripture seems to suggest is that God doesn't like the worship of people who are not actually living lives of dedication to him. God doesn't want a temple built by people who are living lives that are an affront to him and that are an abomination before him. So get your life pure, and then God will accept your worship. Get your life clean, and then he'll appreciate your temple. Don't build the temple with unclean hands. And so that was kind of a challenge to get your lives right if you're going to be building this temple. But then that fourth and final prophecy, look at verse 20 of chapter 2. It says, then the word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, saying, I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of the kingdoms of the nations. And I will overthrow the chariots and their riders, and the horses and their riders will go down, everyone by the sword of another. And on that day, declares the Lord, I will take you, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, my servant, declares the Lord, and I will make you, notice this, like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts. Remember that passage we read about the signet ring where he tells his grandfather, I'm taking you off and the nations are going to come and destroy you? Well, this word of prophecy ends by telling Zerubbabel, you're my signet ring. I'm putting you right on my finger. And those other nations that have terrified you and that have you know, decimated Jerusalem, those nations are going to be shaken and those nations are going to fall. I'm going to make you my servant. What an incredible reversal. What an incredible word of encouragement. It's like Jeremiah had said to his grandfather the exact opposite. And as he's down and discouraged and looking at the temple, and it's not what it's looking like he should be, and he sees all these people who'd rather be working on their own houses, and he looks out and he sees people who are living impure lives and building the temple, and all of a sudden God looks at him and he doesn't say, I have rejected you because you're doing an awful job. Instead, what he says is, you're my servant. I'm going to wear you like a signet ring, and you don't have to worry about those other nations coming in here to destroy you. I've chosen you. That's a pretty powerful message for a leader who is very discouraged. I think one of the things that God believes leaders need is encouragement. If you have a job to do, if you have to be the light of the world, he wants to encourage you in that process. If you have a task that you believe is monumental, he's going to want to encourage you in that process. The book of Zechariah continues some of these same themes, and Zechariah is a lot longer, so we're not going to go through all of Zechariah like we just did Haggai, but there are two night visions that Zechariah has that I want to focus on. One of them is to Joshua, and the other one is to Zerubbabel. Look with me at Zechariah chapter 3. So Zechariah begins with like a series of visions that Zechariah is having, and they're teaching him all kinds of valuable things that he is then prophesying to the people. And some of them are messages of judgment, some of them are rather encouraging. We're going to see two back-to-back that I think are pretty encouraging. One is specifically to the high priest Joshua, and the other one is specifically to Zerubbabel, the governor. If you look at chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right side to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, 'The Lord rebuke you, Satan. Indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not the brand plucked from the fire?' Now Joshua was clothed in filthy garments standing before the angel." So get this in your mind. It's a courtroom scene. And you have Satan, the prosecutor, who's there, and you have the angel of the Lord who's there, and you have the Lord who's there, and it appears on trial you have Joshua. And he's standing there in filthy clothes. Those filthy clothes represent the sins of Israel. They represent the sins of the people, and he's a priest. You know, there's quite a bit about priests and their clothing, and they're supposed to have the proper attire. They're supposed to look right. And he is in very obviously filthy clothes. It's like you're on trial for some crime, and they have a clear videotape of you committing the crime. And there's no way that you can say, well, the tape was doctored, or you can try to come up with something, but your guilt is obvious on plain sight before everyone who's there, and Joshua is standing there wearing his guilt before the prosecutor, before the judge. And Satan is there, the one who is accusing and condemning. And you know what? Satan has a pretty solid case. Satan could look and say, "This is your priest. Just take a quick glance at him." You could see the filth of Israel all over him. But the story continues. Look at verse 4. "And he spoke and said to those who were standing before him, saying, 'Remove the filthy garments from him.' And again he said, 'See, I have taken your iniquity away from you and will clothe you with festal robes.' And then I said," so here's where Zechariah, he's watching this scene and then he chimes in and he shouts out, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head and they clothed him with garments while the angel of the Lord was standing by. You know what happens in this courtroom scene? Satan thinks he has a slam dunk case against Joshua, against the high priest, against Israel. And as he's there, these people are back from Babylonian captivity. They've been idolatrous. They've been weak. They've messed around with sin, like all sorts of stuff. And he's going to have an excellent case. He's going to be able to condemn them, obviously, before anyone. And right then, the Lord takes off the filthy clothes, puts on the clean clothes, they put on a nice clean turban, he wears the festal robes, and all of a sudden, Satan is watching his case disappear before his eyes, and he realizes, well, that's not fair, you know, you can't just ignore all of the sin and put him in clean robes, and God kind of says, yes, I can. God has a way of doing that. That's what forgiveness looks like. That's what the cleansing that comes from God looks like. And this is such an important message because Israel and the leaders of Israel returning from Babylonian captivity, they know their guilt. They know the sin that they've engaged in. And here you're seeing that God is giving them a fresh start. God has a mission for us as Christians into the world. He has a mission for us. But you know the first thing he does? He removes our sin. He forgives us. And that frees us up to go live out that mission. If you were called to be the light of the world and you were still covered in the sin and darkness of this world, that's going to be pretty hard to do. The first thing God's going to do is remove that from you. In baptism, we arise from the water as people who are forgiven of our sins, and that has removed the chains and the bonds that have held us back and tied us down. Now we can go and live for him. And so that's what we are called to do. Though you were the slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered, and having been set free from sin, you become slaves of obedience. That's Romans chapter 6. The idea is the slavery to sin that we had is removed. Those filthy garments are removed. The darkness of sin is removed, and now you are freed up to live what God has called you to be. That's a word of encouragement. You've been forgiven, so move on. You've been forgiven, so live a new life. You've been forgiven, so you're free to be who God has called you to be, and you don't have to keep looking back and being held back by the sins of your past. If you are looking at your life and you're thinking, I have this monumental task in front of me, but I'm so weak, recognize the forgiveness of God is there, And he can free you up to be who he's called you to be. That's what he does for Joshua. Then you get to chapter 4. And we have a second word, and this one is to Zerubbabel. It says, then the angel who was speaking with me returned, and he roused me as a man who is awakened from a sleep. And he said to me, what do you see? And so here we're going to see a vision. It's not a vision of a courtroom scene anymore. It's a vision of a lamp, a really special, incredible lamp. Verse 2 says, I see, and behold, a lampstand, all of gold with its bowl on the top of it, and yet seven lamps on it, and seven spouts belonging to each lamp, which are on top of it. And also two olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl and one on the left side of the bowl. Okay, so he sees this lamp, and it's like it has seven different lamps on top where the light comes from. But it also has a big bowl, and the bowl has funnels that go down, and they fill the lamp with oil. So basically the way these lamps work is there was oil in them, and you would light the oil, and the oil would stay. But what happens when you run out of oil? Well, you need to get new oil. Well, this one has a big bowl full of oil on top, so it can stay lit. But then to the right and to the left of it, guess what? There are olive trees, these eternal sources of oil, and these gold pipes that you'll read about here in a little bit, that connect the olive trees to the bowl. So the bowl is constantly being filled with oil as the lamp is constantly being filled with oil. So it's like the most incredibly constructed lamp of all time that it's not going to go dim. It's a lamp that can stay lit because it's connected to a source of light. It has the olive oil going up into the big bowl and dropping down into the seven. And it's like this lamp will always perpetually stay lit. And so Zerubbabel sees this and he doesn't know what it means. Verse 4 says, then I said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these things, my Lord? And the angel who was speaking with me answered and said, do you not know what these are? And I said, I don't know. You know, no, my Lord. Then he said to me, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. That's the passage we referenced this morning. It's in Zechariah 4:6. And how is Zerubbabel going to accomplish the task that's before him? God actually tells him, it's not going to be by your might. And it's not going to be by your power. You are Zerubbabel, the seed of Babylon. You do come from a sinful line. You yourself are a sinful person. You might be able to try to overcome and all that, but the reality is you're flawed. We are all flawed. We can all look at our lives and see the reasons for our failure. But you remember the end of the book of Haggai that says, I'm going to choose you. You're my servant. I'm putting you on like a signet ring. I'm going to protect you from those other nations. Well, here you have God saying, I have chosen you, and you're going to be successful. It's not going to be by your might. It's not going to be by your power. It will be by my spirit who gives you strength. So, verse 7, we get a glimpse of the power. He says, what are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you will become a plain. And he who will bring forth the top stone with shouts of grace to it. That stone is likely a reference to the temple itself. But what you see right there is, you know, who has the power to turn a mountain into a plain? I don't, but God does. God could do that. And what God is saying is before Zerubbabel, mountains will be turned into plains because God is on his side. Verse 8, also the word of the Lord came to me saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. That's talking about the temple. And his hands will finish it. Then you will have known that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. So the Lord is giving him this word of encouragement right now. Look, your hands started the temple. Your hands will finish the temple. He then asks a little bit more about that lamp. One thing I want to, verse 10, before we get to that. In verse 10, a really neat passage says, for who has despised the day of small things? But these seven will be glad when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. When it talks about the day of small things, I think what's possibly being referenced there is kind of the same thing that we mentioned earlier when they saw the temple. The temple was not able to be as impressive as they once thought it was. Like the temple of Solomon was so much more glorious. The work that they're doing looks like small things. And a lot of times people despise small things. People look down on small things. People think that small things don't matter. But in my experience and in talking with other people and seeing the way churches work, you'd be amazed how often it is the small things that are done consistently and faithfully end up having the biggest impact over time, rather than big, huge, sweeping changes or big, huge new projects or new ministries with bells and whistles. Sometimes it's just the small things, being friendly. Sometimes it's the small things, reaching out and having a meal with somebody. Sometimes it's the small things, giving someone a phone call or writing a card, that end up making the greatest difference in the lives of the individual people you meet. We shouldn't despise small things. In fact, we should encourage small things. We should encourage daily faithfulness in the little things, because a lot of times those end up producing the biggest things, not by strength and not by power, but by the Spirit of God. Finally, we come to find out that there are, from these olive trees, these golden pipes that are connecting it up to that lamp, that are filling it with oil. And we're asked, he asks who the trees are. And we're told in verse 14, these are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth. And there's discussion about who those two anointed ones are. But in the context, having just seen Joshua and having just seen Zerubbabel, it might very well be that God is using Joshua and Zerubbabel to be the ones who are filling the oil that is lighting the lamp of Israel as they continue to do this work and to rebuild the temple. So again, you have quite a message of encouragement. You have a message of encouragement saying, you're going to be my signet ring that I wear again. You have the message of encouragement saying, I've taken off the filthy clothes and I've put new, clean, fresh garments on you. You have the message of encouragement that it's not going to be by your might and it's not going to be by your power, but by my Spirit. But the work that your hand started, your hand will finish. And you shouldn't despise the day of small things. Now, having said all of that, I want to look over at the book of Ezra just really quickly as we draw our lesson to a close, because something really cool happens in the book of Ezra. If you look at Ezra chapter 3 and verse 10, this is shortly after they return home from a Babylonian captivity. What they start doing is rebuilding the temple. Verse 10 says, now when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood with their apparel and trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord according to the direction of King David of Israel. And they sang praises and gave thanks to the Lord, saying, for he is good and his loving kindness endures forever. That's a repeated phrase in the Psalms. This great worship service takes place when they lay the foundation of the temple. But then again, day passes, week passes, month passes, year passes, and they don't get back to work on it. It's like you think great things are going to happen, but then the temple lies there, dormant, just ignored. And then you see chapter 5 and verse 1. Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1 says, when the prophets Haggai, that's who we just read a moment ago, and the prophet Zechariah, the son of Iddo, we just read him a moment ago, when they prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah in Jerusalem in the name of the Lord God who was over them, then Zerubbabel, that's who we were just talking about, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jehozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So you remember those downtrodden leaders of Israel? They heard these messages, and they actually did it. By the way, how often in the Old Testament does a prophet say something and one of the leaders of Israel change anything? It's pretty rare. Like, most of the time prophets say things, they're ignored or they're punished for it. But here you actually have, they give these words of encouragement and they give these words of support. That's what it says. They're supporting them. And then they get to work and they start rebuilding the temple. Like, these messages of encouragement actually worked. And they got up and they started working on it. And look at chapter 6 and verse 14. Chapter 6 and verse 14 of Ezra says, and the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. And they finished building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus. So here you have, like, the prophets encouraged the people to do something. They heard the message. They accepted it. They got up and they obeyed it. And the temple was able to be completed. They were able to do this unbelievable, insurmountable task. Why? Because God was with them, because God loved them, and because God encouraged them through it. It wasn't by strength, it wasn't by power, but it was by the Spirit of the Lord. In this passage, we actually see how those two books turned out. It's like you can read Haggai and Zechariah, and then at the end, you don't know what happened. Well, you can go to the book of Ezra and find out. It worked. The prophesying was successful. Zerubbabel and Joshua, they were encouraged. They did the task that was at hand. Israel joined them, and they completed the temple of the Lord. And so Jesus has given us some pretty difficult tasks, some pretty challenging tasks. And the question is, what are we going to do? I don't think we'll be able to do it by our strength or by our power, but by his Spirit. We can plant, we can water, but God's the one who will give the increase. We can work hard for the kingdom. We can live for the kingdom. We can try the best that we can, and I think we should. And rather than judging how well we've done based on the results, judge based on your faithfulness and see what God does. Trust in the Lord and lean not on your own understanding, but see what he can actually do. Because the Lord can do the impossible. The Lord can do more with you than you realize. So what will you allow him to do? Work for him and see what happens. If there's anyone here tonight who would like the prayers of the church, would like to confess sins, would like help, would like to become a Christian by having your sins washed away in baptism, please let that be known. Come sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.